once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. Welcome back to another mostly not boring, exciting episode of the Personal Wealth Coach. We got lots to talk about this hour.
Yep.
I've got discussions about finger pointing at the port of Los Angeles between the truck drivers and the crane operators. We've got one side calling the other side lazy, the other side calling the other annoying. Hey, we're back to schoolyard politics, folks. Traffic jam and road rage when you're not even on a road. So do you want to just jump into that one? It's a good one to talk about.
Traffic jam and road rage?
Well, yeah, but only in the port of LA instead of on the road.
Well, there's a lot of ships anchored offshore at Long Beach in LA. Mm-hmm. LA having the largest port of entry in the United States.
About 40% of our imports come through that port, just as a side note. Go ahead.
Interestingly, our balance of trade deficit, which isn't real, but it's reported, is getting rather large, relatively speaking. But there's an interesting thing going on. Our export prices have gone up dramatically faster this year than import prices. So people that are buying things from us are seeing us raise the prices for what they're buying faster than other people raising the prices for what we are buying, which is an interesting phenomenon, and it is continuing to accelerate. But we do have a serious problem, and that is we here in the United States have gotten used to the fact that if we want something, we can have it, which I can clearly remember because I'm old, a time when just because you wanted something didn't mean that it was available. Just because you routinely would order something long in advance that you wanted that would be available to be available sometime in the future. And there are lots of things you wanted that simply weren't available unless you were very, very wealthy.
It doesn't actually have to be that long back in time. It maybe 20 years ago, I had a llama wrench and I had a belt that I needed to replace on my tractor. And I had to wait for 3 months to get that belt to come in. We kind of moved away from that. That belt was on demand for a lot of people for the last 20 years. So we look at this as another behavioral thing. You know, when they first started allowing Wi-Fi on the airplanes?
Yeah.
My first flight after them allowing Wi-Fi on the airplanes was maybe 2 days after they allowed it. So I got on the airplane. I sat down. The guy next to me is opening up his laptop and he's getting all set and ready to go. And the Wi-Fi went down. And he went ballistic. Man, he was so mad. He went all over talking about, you advertised that this was going to be here, and I had it yesterday, and I don't have it today. I wanted to watch my movie, and my little daughter is going to be so upset that she can't watch this movie. And I'm just going, you just got this. It just happened. And now the fact that you don't have it means something horrible has occurred. And that's what we're experiencing right now.
We've gotten used to having very specific foods in our house, very narrowly defined, one brand of salad, of olive oil and vinegar salad dressing, and all these, give them a plug, Newman's Own, which we think is really cool. We like it a lot, and we used quite a lot of it in various recipes and so on. And we've gotten so used to having this esoteric, one narrow brand, and when the logistics problems hit and it wasn't on the shelves, we were disappointed. And the other thing that we've gotten used to this very recently, obviously, is being able to get online and order something and have it within 2 days.
Right. Or one day, a lot of times.
Or one day. And when you go online and you order it and say, I'm sorry, there's a delay. It's going to be 2 weeks before you get this. We go, what is wrong with this terrible world we're in? The world is falling apart.
The world is broken.
And it is. I remember when we used to go to the grocery store long, long ago and far away, and there was flour in the grocery store.
Yeah.
That was it. Flour. I mean, you had a choice. You could have flour or you could have flour. That was it. And now you look at all the abundance of different kinds of flours.
What kind of flour was it? Was it gluten-free or was it rice?
Yeah.
Or
was it, it was just flour. Well, just flour.
Yeah, but
wheat flour. Well, it wasn't even called wheat flour. It was just called flour. And there weren't any of the others. And we've gotten so used to it and so spoiled by the abundance of instantly available whatever we want that we see it as a terrible crisis when we can't get exactly what we want as quickly as we want it, immediately, if not sooner, and we say the world's coming to an end. It's not.
It's not. And the reality is that the logjam will get cleaned up. Why do I say that? Because a lot of money is at stake. People's jobs, putting it lightly, but the profitability of companies in general, if you can come up with a better way of getting stuff to people quicker, then you're going to be ahead of the competition. And that's what's going on. We've got some other weird issues, and this we can tie this in between what's going on at the Port of LA and eventually into the natural gas crisis, the crisis of natural gas, when we didn't even think about using natural gas as a major source of anything 20 years ago. It was just not what was being done. So when we look at what's going on at the Port of LA, we've just got absolutely huge numbers of ships hanging out waiting their turn. We don't have enough slips for them to come in. We don't have enough crane operators. And just as a side note, I have known crane operators closely. That is a high-stress job. Truck drivers are, this hit the Wall Street Journal yesterday, that truck drivers are complaining about the way that the crane operators are acting, because they're taking long lunch breaks and they're telling people to come to the port because they're ready to move the cargo. And then the truck driver has to wait multiple hours, and sometimes they have to come back. And when they complain, they're blacklisted and they're not allowed to come into the port. I just have to say, I don't know about the internal politics of that. What I do know is for a truck driver to create $1 billion worth of damage is pretty unheard of. It's really hard for them to do that. Crane operators could at any moment damage equipment that is in the billions of dollars in both the dock and shipping stuff that they've got on the containers full of stuff. If they knock a bunch of that stuff into the ocean, or you're talking about a huge mess, and they are working overtime. So just be aware that we've got some automation coming there too. And we've got folks that are making $250,000 a year in this very high pressure job that still has accidents. The LA last year, when traffic was low, you have to go to the LA Times to pick this up, because it's absolutely not worldwide news when an accident happens at the port. But quite a lot of shipping containers were put on a truck the wrong way and trapped the truck, or nearly hurt somebody, or people get hurt. It's going to be automated, and that's going to speed this up dramatically, as are the truck drivers being automated. The port system is one of the places that automation will be picked up relatively quickly, I believe.
The logistics logjam is not just at the ports. It's huge at the ports. The ports, Port of LA, for example, is probably going to follow Long Beach in the immediate future and go into 24-hour operation. The ports on the West Coast are only operating at about 60% efficiency. Primarily because of the truck drivers. And the point is that they tried opening up late at night and the truck drivers weren't showing up. And part of that is union rules, and part of it is regulatory requirements. There's a lot of bureaucratic reasons this has not happened.
Right. As a side note, the Longshoremen's Union is in a fight with the Teamsters Union over this.
Mm-hmm.
Big one. And the Teamsters think they're in the right, and the Longshoremen think they're in the right. It's the same argument that's happened at the docks since oxen and carts were used. That's why they were called Teamsters. And longshoremen rode longboats.
There's actually a regulation that says if you show up with a truck without a container on it, you can't pick up a container.
Because you have to bring an empty one to pick up the loaded one.
Yeah, and they have an excess of loaded ones, but they still got the regulation and they can't change it easily, so bureaucracy is getting in the way. But we have another big logjam occurring near Chicago, where trains, at least a couple of weeks ago, were backed up 25 miles because the freight yards where they offload those containers to be put on trucks were completely full. There was no place to put them anymore.
Oh.
And when they put them someplace other than where they were supposed to go, they blocked trucks from getting to containers, from taking them out. And why is there a shortage of trucks to take the containers out? Well, it turns out that COVID has hit truck drivers much harder than it has hit the rest of the population, because simply, a lot of truck drivers didn't get vaccinated.
No.
And I can even understand why they didn't get vaccinated.
In the middle of all of this, I'm going to throw some weird stuff out there just because it's funny. About this time, well, a couple of months before this last year, it was in June of last year, empty container boxes were dirt cheap, cheaper than dirt. Sometimes people were just paying other people to get rid of them. And we had a radio program listener that talked to me about that time period and said, hey, I want to build with containers. And we talked about the problems with that and the benefits of that. There's as many problems as benefits. And so, but I said, but it's a great time to buy cargo containers right now. They're dirt cheap and everybody's got too many. So I heard back from him last month, and he made a very large amount of money by buying up a bunch of containers and then selling them last month. He bought them a year ago and he sold them last month, and he made a huge amount of money. But he was talking to me at the point saying, I'm kicking myself. I could have waited another month and nearly doubled the prices again. So this is somebody that had their head screwed on correctly and said, hey, there's an inefficiency here. It is cheap. I bet it's not going to be cheap in the future. Only he didn't say that. He was just thinking it's cheap. I'll get it now. And then it got really expensive. So he did well. But that's kind of part of the problem, is that people paid people to dump these containers last year. Literally. Like, take them somewhere and get rid of them. We've got no room to put all these empty containers anymore. The Chinese didn't get any empty containers back because we weren't ordering stuff from China. They still had containers that they were shipping out. So we have empty containers all over the east coast of Africa. We've got empty containers on the east and west coast of South America that are just completely inaccessible now. The Venezuelan shipping containers were brought in for humanitarian relief, and they're still sitting there, and nobody wants to take their ships into port to pick up the empty containers because people try to get on the boats. So the world is snarled in the combination of normal governmental shifts, normal economic movements, and then a massive plague. And we'll get through this because we invented the system that shipped to the world so quickly to begin with. And there's a great paper we talked about before the program started, and I've got to find the link to it and go back to it. It's a good paper, and it talks about how disability leads to innovation. That if you have something that works well and it doesn't work well for a while, it leads to the thing that worked well before working better in the future. That's how we innovate. We have to have a need before we innovate. Well, there is a front and center in everybody's crosshairs need to innovate, and it's happening. There's a massive automation push going on in this industry.
There's a couple of things I want to talk about. One is, this has happened before, but the other one, we have another question from John. Good question. Are U.S. exports having the same problem leaving as imports arriving? Some are and some aren't. Getting them, the things we put in containers and we ship overseas are moving out fairly quickly. But one of our principal exports, and this is something that in a normal year would have made headlines, our farmers' grain exports are, the price is super high and the world wants more than we can provide, and we're same doing with, just wonderful.
Yeah, same with liquid natural gas. The but Chinese are calling directly Texas frackers at this point, and I've gotten some interesting feedback on that, where the Texas fracker picks up the phone and is speaking to somebody with very broken English, wishing to buy a large amount of liquid natural gas from a pumping station in the middle of the panhandle. And they're like, so the Chinese are trying to figure out how to get more liquid natural gas from the United States.
The problem is, and they're actually starting to put grain in containers now, you know, the shipping containers that right. you see on the back of trains and trucks. We've never done that before. But there is some difficulty in getting grain out because it's not normally put in containers. We are having some problems in getting it out of the United States. That's not the big problem. The problem is that, and one of the reasons we're having this snafus go on, is ports are shutting down in places like China. The entire port shuts down because China still has the philosophy of zero COVID.
Yeah.
They get a COVID infection in a port area and they shut the city down, they shut the port down. And when they open up again, there's a big surge of incoming and outgoing stuff. Australia, New Zealand, and most of the rest of the world that was operating under, and in Vietnam, for example, were operating under zero COVID. Whenever there was a COVID infection, they would shut everything down around it and isolate it and wipe it out. But Delta was moving faster than they could do that, and it was wrecking their economy. The United States took the opposite track. We said, we don't care how many COVID infections there are, just to a degree. We're not going to try to have zero COVID. And we've had, as a result, a lot of people, a lot more people per 100,000 die. But our economy is going like gangbusters, whereas the Chinese economy is teetering on the verge of recession right now.
And that is
largely because of COVID shutdowns.
Yeah, that is an extremely rare event. It's like last 30 years, China doesn't have recessions because the government has been so good at stepping in. And they're scared. This is part of why the crackdown is occurring. They're getting a lot of these bigger public figures in the tech world shut up, is because if they hit a recession, I can tell you a theory I developed in economics at the very budding of my economic career called the cattail theory. And it was based on studies of Rome. It was based on pandemics and studies of Rome. So when people talk about pandemics and stuff, I've been studying this stuff for decades. And the cattail theory was my very simplified label for overly complex math, but it comes back to very simple concept of the government, if it tries to calm out inflation, if it tries to calm out the marketplace, if it tries to calm out supply and demand because there's too much movement, it's very much like sitting next to a cat whose tail is lightly twitching. For those of you that have had cats in your life, that's a fairly normal thing. They're sitting there. Just the tip of the tail is twitching just a little bit. So if we, as the governing force here, the government, reach down and say, I'm just going to add some stability here. I'm going to keep that twitch from occurring. I'm going to put my hand gently on the tail and just prevent it from moving. If you ever had a cat, you know what happens when you let go. And that is what the Chinese are afraid of. Now, they don't call it the cattail theory. They have some Chinese equivalent to it. But that's what they're afraid of. If they release that iron hold on the economy, on the banks, on the ability for someone to speak negatively about China, then when bad things happen, they'll happen really badly. The Chinese, the Communist Party, could lose control. If they have a bad recession while they have a bunch of people that everybody respects talking bad about the government. So this is why the people that everybody respects that are in the private banking world, that have been meeting at conferences in America, that have been making movies in America, they're being stifled right now because the Chinese are terrified. We talked about it going more and more autocratic and they're making bad decisions. If they see their current movement leading to a recession, they're actually making good decisions for the benefit of the Communist Party there, of the people in control, by limiting dissent before it occurs. It sounds like I just gave them a compliment. I don't believe in their system of government in any way, but when you look at what they're trying to accomplish with the decisions and choices that they're making, it certainly makes sense from their perspective. When people look at it and say, it doesn't make sense what Xi Jinping is doing over there. Why is he stifling his technologies, messing up his innovation? It's because if they hit a recession and he hasn't done that, then Jack Ma might have been the next prime minister or dictator or whatever it's called when a government shifts to a new government completely. And they're aware of that because that's happened throughout history in China. They're really good at looking at long term.
They call their leader chairman.
Right.
They don't call him president or king or emperor. They call him chairman.
That's our translation. And that's the funny thing is that it is chairman or head of a committee.
What I think is funny is he's always standing while everyone else is sitting, but he's the chairman.
Right.
Which doesn't make any sense.
Does it translate right. now as chairperson or is it still translating as chairman?
Is this China?
But it's the chairman. Translation goes with our language.
Yeah, well, it is literally chairman.
Okay, chairman.
Yes, chairman.
Makes sense. Yeah. All right, so that's when
we got
looking
other stuff
at,
to talk about,
yeah,
too.
This is just fascinating to us. There's so many data points out there that are moving around. It's just phenomenally educational watching what people are doing in the middle of this.
Oh, we got another question. If you guys have time, this is from Chris. Can you talk about how interest rates rising will affect government borrowing and our national debt in the future? Is this a concern? No. Okay. Anything else you want to talk about?
Wait. Did you say no? We're not going to talk about it. That's perfect.
No, it's not.
We're not going to. Oh, I thought it was. Oh. Would you guys mind talking about it? We just said, no, we're not going to talk about it.
This is a sensitive subject.
It is. There's a lot of politics involved here.
First off, the amount of money our government owes in bonds, notes, bills, et cetera, is small relative to its net worth. Yeah, right. we have a bigger debt relative to GDP than we've had before, except for during World War II. But
right. When we compare this like against a private person, when the bank is wishing mm-hmm. to give you a loan and your net worth is, say, $10 million, and you want a $3.1 million loan, they go, well, I don't know, what's your income look like? Yeah, your income's all right. As a percentage of the payment's going to be, yeah, okay, I think you can do it. You got to remember to leave net worth in the equation.
And you also, there's another factor here, and it's a big one. It is so big that literally people don't talk about it. The largest single holder right now of U.S. debt, that's bills, bonds, and so on, U.S. Treasury borrowings, is the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve has the ability to go in and buy up that debt at a virtually unlimited rate. It could literally, if the Federal Reserve decided to do so, buy all the U.S. debt, which would be very disruptive to the world economy. And they would never do that, I don't think. So it isn't like you're borrowing money from the bank or borrowing money from a credit card that has to all be paid back. The Federal Reserve does not necessarily, could very easily say, we forgive your debt, and it would just go away. Now, are they going to do that? No, because again, it would disrupt the market. But here's the important thing to recognize. The danger in borrowing, of the federal government borrowing money, is it's when it borrows money, it spends that money. It puts it back into the economy. How efficiently it does it is beside the point. It puts the money back into the economy. If the federal government gets to the point where it's borrowing so much money that it's not collecting in taxes, that it begins to cause inflation, then you've got a problem. Is the federal government's borrowing causing the current round of inflation? No, there's no evidence of that happening whatsoever. What is causing inflation is the fact that there are supply constraints caused primarily secondary or tertiarily by COVID right now. And the Federal Reserve has the ability to control how much money is in circulation. And the rest of the world is sopping up the money we create at a very high rate of speed. We have a huge export. It's called the dollar. And it's not a matter of just us and them. It's a matter of, and we've talked about this before, Jake's talked about it, I've talked about it. An example, the second largest economy in the world, the Chinese, have a currency, the renminbi, or sometimes called the yuan.
Yuan.
It is basically backed by U.S. dollar denominated securities, treasury securities. When the Chinese go to buy raw materials, and by the way, several times during this pandemic, they have been net importers instead of net exporters, as they used to be. They actually imported more value than they exported for several months in a row. They pay for that using dollars. They pay for that using all those dollars that they get from us. So it's a matter of the world, it's called the world reserve currency, but basically the world currency is the dollar. Oil is bought and sold only in dollars. Unless you're buying it from Iran, and they'll accept euros sometimes if the wind's blowing in the right direction. And the Russians would love to sell their oil in rubles, but nobody wants their rubles, and nobody has enough rubles to pay for it with, so they also buy and sell in dollars. So we have this export that we maintain quality control on called the dollar. How long will this last? Well, for Rome, it lasted about 800 years, and it didn't cause the collapse of Rome. The collapse of Rome caused the Roman denarius to lose value, not the other way around. So we've got a situation where the prime evidence we can present is one of the more stable economies in the world right now is the Japanese economy. Very little inflation, very stable, and they have a national debt that's 250% of their gross domestic product, and it hasn't had a negative effect in any way whatsoever. No, that's something to be aware of.
We didn't tell them what the household net worth of the United States is. This doesn't involve all the corporate net worth, because sometimes it's not held by households. But if we add it all together, it is significantly more than this. But it's $141 trillion is the net worth of the households in the United States. $141, when we talk about net worth, that's minus debt. And when we look at who owns the debt, a big chunk of the debt is owned by U.S. citizens. If we look at it's man, I could add it all up together, but the Federal Reserve and the government accounts, that's like $11 trillion of our $28 trillion debt. So when we look at it, we say, all right, is this dangerous at this moment? Almost any metric we apply to the debt of the United States at this moment, it looks healthy. That obviously could change if we crazy borrow into the future forever. So don't hear us saying, hey, the debt is healthy at this moment. It to somehow imply that we're advocating for massive amounts of borrowing for everything into the future. What we are saying is this is not going to... It, under these circumstances, we don't see this leading to the decline of the United States as the power of the world. If anything, it's the opposite, in that the foreign holding of debt of the U.S. government is $7 trillion. And when you look at the world stage at how much money that is and where it came from, you're going to discover that that is a big investment in our well-being, because they don't get paid back if they really get into war with us. Japan's the top holder. China's the second top holder foreign-wise. But China's got $1 trillion of our debt.
Now, if we were to allow interest rates to rise dramatically, as they did in the late 70s and early 80s, before we had the controls on the situation that we have today,
right,
it would have a negative effect, because so much of the federal budget would go to pay interest. But one of the things that the Federal Reserve is in the business of doing is not allowing inflation and interest rates to rise real high.
Yeah. So when we're kind of tying back into all the questions that we've had today, have been bordering on inflation and supply chain and price changes. When things are hard to get, they get more expensive. As they get easier to get, they get less expensive. And as money is siphoned out of the system, people will have less money to pay for things, so it won't be money's no issue. The companies will have to compete for that money to find the most efficient route to get the stuff to them. That we see already happening.
One of the unstated missions of the Federal Reserve, and it is unstated, it's there clearly because it supports the stated missions, is controlling the supply and demand of dollars. And they have proven that they can do a really, really, really good job of that. And they can keep interest rates, they can raise interest rates, they can lower interest rates. It used to be that the buying of longer-term treasuries on the open market, or the buying of other bonds on the open market, was an extremely rare event for the Federal Reserve. Now they do it routinely. They buy and sell on the open market at longer maturities than just the short-term rates. And they are the 800-pound gorilla. They have a tremendous ability to move the bond market. And as long as things don't get completely out of whack, can we get completely out of whack? Sure, we could get completely out of whack, but nothing, including the $3.5 trillion budget, would put things completely out of whack.
No.
The Federal Reserve could buy up that debt and it wouldn't even make a blip.
So let's kind of lay out a perspective, though. Interest payments earlier in this year, we don't have the most up-to-date figures, were projected for 2021, interest payments on the debt of the U.S. government were projected to be about $300 billion. That's a lot. They're obligated to pay the coupon rate. So as interest rates rise, that old debt that we're talking about, the $300 billion on, that's not rising with it. It's any new debt that would be taken on would be at the higher interest rate. And that can raise the payment. Also, as old debt matures and is brought back up for reissuance, because basically if we are growing our debt over a long period of time, we're not paying it off. As it matures, we're replacing it with a new bond. That will increase the cost of interest payment for the federal budget. And that's something we just have to be aware of. It's something that needs to be calculated in. $300 billion is a lot of money. It's about 10%, a little under 10% of the budget. And as interest rates go up, that will go up too. So that's something to worry about if you plan on worrying. Otherwise, we need to look at how to raise revenue to pay for the spending that we want to do. And that means tax increases. Or we need to cut back on the big expenses, which are things that nobody wants to cut, like defense and Medicare and Social Security. who's going to volunteer to start talking about cutting things that are kind of important for us all? So that's the deal, is that we've got to come to some kind of conclusion on what we're willing to spend into the future. But
well, there's another aspect to this. When you buy stocks in your 401k or whatever, when you buy mutual funds, you are in essence creating debt. I know that sounds kind of backwards, but your money is out there someplace and you don't have access to it anymore unless you liquidate something and try to get it back. You're putting a risk factor in your life for a reason. It's similar to when you buy a house. You accumulate a tremendous amount of debt. Let's say you bought a $300,000 house and you don't make $300,000 a year. You just entered into and you had a VA loan. Let's just throw lots of things in here. And you don't make $300,000 a year. You just acquired a debt that is larger than your income. And yet that's normal. Why? Because you consider that debt to be an investment. It's a double-edged investment. One, the fact that you have the nice house will enable you to make money more effectively, will enable your children to be better educated, will enable for a lot of things to happen that otherwise wouldn't happen. And secondly, you expect the price of that house to rise over the years and become more valuable as time goes by. A lot of the money that's being budgeted in that, for instance, in that $3.5 trillion budget that is so strongly objected to, that's probably going to come down quite a lot before it passes, is investment money. Some of this is investment money in children. Some of it is investment money in childcare. Some of it is investment money. Not all of it's investment money, but much of it is money that is.
There's a lot of pork in there too. You can look at any budget bill, and you just got to plug your nose and walk by all the pork and bacon because it's there. Don't get us wrong. There's a lot of it in there, but there's a lot of investment money in there too.
Even the pork and bacon, in many cases, turns around and becomes something useful. For instance, let me give you an example.
Can I quick run in?
Sure.
The reason why we use pork when we talk about pork barrel spending is because the government subsidized the pork industry when that name for the budget came up. And it actually led to a large amount of tax revenue to the government when the pork industry got very profitable not long afterwards. So there's a question even about the word pork. Pork barrel spending. Did the government have a place in investing in the pork industry when it was an established industry? It was just because they really wanted the government to give them money. Did they have a place to do it? Well, they had the votes. It's a democracy. That's what happens. Was it the best spending in the world? Maybe, maybe not. When you pay for something that has no long-term benefit, what's something that the government does that has no long-term benefit? Post office?
No, it is a great long-term
benefit.
That's
a long-term benefit. Wait, let's see. The Army. Nope, the Army's got a long-term. So that's the problem. Yeah, there may be waste involved, but it's really hard to find something that the government is doing that doesn't provide a long-term benefit. That's hard.
Let me give you an example. And I objected at the time, not to the project so much as the way it was presented. Representative Carter gave two speeches in one day, one in Temple where he was talking about cutting the budget, and the other one in Copper's Cove where he was bragging that he earmarked a bunch of money to put the new big intersection that, by the way, led to nowhere at the time.
But it led to somewhere later.
Off 190 in Copper's Cove, and was really proud of that and made everybody happy. The fact is that intersection, because that big interchange on the highway there at 190, spawned a bypass. And whether or not it was obvious needed at the time, it was considered, it was labeled as pork barrel spending by some people at the time. It was earmarked, which is pork.
Yeah.
But the point is, it created a bypass around Copper's Cove that kept Copper's Cove from becoming log jammed, car jammed permanently with cars as the economy has grown. It actually created a growth in the economy. There are a lot of people that were saying when we put in the 140, is it 140, the bypass that goes around Austin, the toll road, that was a waste of money and it was a waste of effort and it was terrible and it was a terrible thing to do. Why not just drive through on I-35? Because it just went through the middle of nowhere. It didn't go anywhere.
We already paid for I-35. We were going to make a toll road that we have to pay for again. Why would we do that?
So now you go drive down that place that used to run through nowhere, and there are communities developing around it. There's Tesla putting a new plant in next to it. There's tremendous economic development and tax revenue for the state of Texas coming in off of this supposed boondoggle. So when the government borrows money and spends it on something that produces a long-term gain for the government and for society, that is a good use of money. And let me tell you, there's a big change going on right now in the way government borrows money. I don't know if you follow this or not. During the Trump administration, there was a conscious effort from the executive to keep borrowing short-term. Matter of fact, the Secretary of the Treasury and the President got into an argument over it. Keep it short-term so it doesn't look like we have long-term borrowing. And as a result, they were rolling it over very, very quickly. During the current administration, the borrowing has gone long-term. So when we borrow money now, we're taking it out to 20 and sometimes 30 years at these super low interest rates. And it's one of the fascinating things about the debt right now. The interest rate on the 20-year bond is well below what we expect, anybody expects inflation to be over the next 20 years. So we're actually being paid money as a country to borrow money from somebody.
As a business owner, if I was about to be building an addition to our facility or a new manufacturing plant of some kind, I'm not expected to come up with that money out of my current revenue stream. I want to go into debt for that, but I really want that debt to be cheap. And if when I'm heading to the borrowing shop and I see that the borrowing shop is only going to charge me 1.57% for my loan, I'm going to take a lot of money on that. And that's what U.S. Treasury rates are. That's what they're being charged. And I wanted to make sure that that is clear. As most of the time, you'll hear us say, hey, borrowing can be good in certain circumstances, bad in other circumstances. Long-term borrowing at 1.5% for things that are going to build revenue in the future, not a big deal. It's just that's the quibble point. What's going to build revenue? And we've got to play some commercials. That's going to build revenue, hopefully, for KTM and for John Squared Media. Not for us. So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, we have email addresses available for you to send us emails. I know, it's like redundant and repetitive at the same time. Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake or and or Jake at tpwc.com. We'll be back on the other side of these very important commercials. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring
Jeff
and Jake McClure. Whoa. With the video, it's actually we're able to say our own names without stumbling on each other. It's crazy.
A lot of work involved there. Hey, August machine tool orders. Its highest mark in 3 years.
Machine tool orders.
Yes.
Have you
machine
ever
seen tooling orders?
Oh, okay. That's pretty cool.
Machine tools are the things that make
machines.
Hard stuff.
Yeah. Machining tools. Yeah. They're the things that machinists use to make all
stuff.
Kinds of metal things and in very rare cases, wooden things. Yeah. It's magical, from my opinion.
Actually, manufacturing technology orders, all kinds of manufacturing technology, are up 98%. From 2 years ago. Now, why is that important? We mentioned that in the newsletter. Why do we think that's important? When companies, and this is just an indicator, manufacturing is a piece of the United States economy. It's not the biggest piece, but it's an important piece. And when manufacturers look down the road that when they choose to buy a machine tool, they choose to buy physical technology. In many of these cases, by the way, these are computerized machine tools. They're very expensive, and they commit the manufacturer to pay for to invest in something, and it's better make profits over the next 10 years or so, or it's not worth investing in. And when they feel, looking at their markets, looking at everything else that's going on, that this is a good time to make a 10-year investment in the future of the economy, that generally indicates it's a good time to make a 10-year investment in the future of the economy, and indicates the economy is going good places in the near future. That's one of those really esoteric items that I like to follow, and I think it's pretty important to follow.
Yeah, I agree.
It's things are about to get a lot better, in other words. It's what they're saying. I can't make that promise, but I think it's true.
There are a couple of other things touching on inflation. I wanted to touch these things too. The Wall Street Journal, just in its economy section, which is the maybe least read portion of it, is talking about inflation in cities. So this is something that's easy to track. You're looking at the same items in different cities and you compare them. And if you're looking at the same items that they use to track inflation with in general, you can get a really good number. And what they've discovered is something that should not shock any economists, but may shock a lot of people that aren't into economics. And that is that the largest cities had the lowest inflation rates. People go, huh? How is that? Well, in big cities, well, first, let's take a step back. The biggest part of inflation, we mentioned this in the newsletter, we talk about it on the radio quite a bit. The biggest part of inflation that we're seeing right now is in food and energy. Still, if you take those things out, we're not seeing as much inflation as it looks like. But if you just concentrate on food and energy, well, you'd think, well, if you're a big city, shouldn't that be more expensive? You got to get it there. It's not like they make the food there. It's not like they come up with the energy there. Why is it less expensive in New York over the change amount? It's inflated less. And that's because a lot of people in New York live in apartments. It's less expensive to heat an apartment than to eat a single family dwelling.
Than to eat?
Than to heat. There was a silent H. It was hiding.
Well, if you're
Sesame Street skills here.
If you're a termite, then you'd want to eat a family dwelling. But
right, that's true.
Otherwise, you just want to heat it.
So it's cheaper to heat. It's cheaper to cool. And it's also kind of bulk purchasing food. Where it's easier to get the logistical support for the city because there's more market there. So more of the truck drivers are going to the place with the most people, which is keeping the prices from rising as fast in New York than it is just a couple of miles from New York City, where the trucks come to the grocery store maybe 3 times a week. In New York City, you've just got a constant flow of trucks going in and out of New York. So what you've got is that high traffic is leading to less inflation. That tells you that this is temporary inflation. Because if it were not, you would see sort of the opposite. You would see the prices going up just as fast or faster in the big cities because either they have a higher demand or the items are just harder to get. So all of the numbers that we're seeing are still looking at 2 to 3 years of inflation that nobody's going to enjoy, but it is temporary because the technology is coming to help us there.
The word is transitory.
Yeah, that's what everybody, but transit authorities get upset about it. And so I tend to say temporary instead of transitory, just for the fun of it.
And a lot of the shortages that are running inflation up right now, particularly in cars and trucks, are going to go away. Factories are being built to build the chips that are causing the shortages. And the big thing, and this is probably the biggest issue, we don't have core inflation.
Right.
Inflation in 1 month, it was a big deal about the CPI jumping so much in 1 month. But if you pull out the big variables, the ones that bob around and jump around all over the place, inflation was only 0.1% from August to September. And that means That's a 1.2% yield or growth in inflation. Let me get one other thing out of the way here. It's important to recognize what happens when you get inflation in narrow areas as opposed to systemic inflation. When you get inflation in narrow areas, and we are seeing inflation in narrow areas like computer chips, people invest a lot of money there because the price went up. Therefore, it makes sense to invest the money to make money off that high price. And so we're going to build a bunch of factories, and mark this down someplace if you track such things. Down the road a few years, there will be a crash in prices in computer chips because we'll have too many.
Yeah, and the cost of electronic devices will drop significantly.
A few years ago, we had oil at $100 a barrel, and we had peak oil that supposedly already passed, and the world was going to come to an end because oil was going to be so expensive. And then about a year ago, it was negative $35 a barrel. Why? Because when oil gets expensive, and it's working on getting expensive right now, by the way.
Yeah.
It causes people to go out and drill, find ways to make more oil. That's the wonder of a free enterprise capitalist system. And I know it's not particularly popular in some areas right now to talk about capitalism and free enterprises being good, but it certainly improves our standard of living, and it works. This is the important thing. It works. And when we get a crisis in price, when we get a crisis in labor, that's when the innovators jump out there and invent things and create things and manufacture things that automate and raise the standard of living across the board. And it's been going on for hundreds of years since the first industrial revolution, and it's still going on, and I like it.
I've got a couple of predictions. I'm going to jump out on the limb here.
Prediction.
Prediction number one, heating and oil gas prices are going to go up through the winter. Prediction number one. Prediction number two, between now and the end of November, prices for food are going to drop. It's harvest time. Welcome to autumn, folks. So it's all linked to seasons. We usually get the most inflation in food prices in September. Just keep that in mind when we're talking about record-based food price jumps and so on. It's partly, at least, because food grows at certain times of year better than at other times of year. And I realize that's common sense, and it shouldn't be involved in the stock market at all, but economics. And in this case, it's harder to move it around, so it's going to be more expensive than it was.
Yeah.
But there's going to be more of it in a short period of time, and a lot of the grocery chains have been moving to localize their grain purchases, localize their milk purchases, and so on. That's part of the thing that's been happening over the last year. So
there are some very well-respected, by me at least, economists out there that aren't worried about inflation. They're worried about disinflation, yeah, which is similar to deflation, because we are capable of creating production facilities and transportation facilities and means of moving things around at a much higher rate than we've ever done before. Automated trucks are coming online. It's going to happen. And we generally overdo it and push prices down. So we're not worried about inflation, to say the least. And very critically, we're out of time. But if you would like to discuss the idea of portfolio management, having your portfolio managed and your wealth managed, our assistance in wealth and management, the personal wealth coach, we think is a good place to discuss it.
We might be a little prejudiced on the subject, but
we are highly prejudiced on the subject. And you can give us a call during the week. We have live people that answer phones. We don't have a phone tree. And during the week, during the weekends, we of course do have
voicemail.
And you can contact us locally at 254-947-1111.
You can reach that same voicemail on the weekends, real live people on the week, toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com.
That's the same name as the radio show.
Yeah, we've got podcasts, radio programs going back lots and lots of years. You can go to any podcast provider for that as well. You can, at that same website, contact us through the contact form or email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.